Welcome to another episode of That's So Cincinnati. I'm very excited today. Well, first of all, I'm here with my co-host, Burl Love. Hi, Burl.
Hi, Sherry. Yeah, this is, you're going to geek out right now because this is everything that you love in your beat. This is the culmination of a year-long look at how the city is going to dig out of its budget challenges.
We're going to do something very serious, which is talk about the Futures Commission today.
Right.
And then something a little bit light, because our podcast is called That's So Cincinnati. It doesn't need to be serious all the time. And so our special guest today is Josh Sneed, who is a lot of things.
He is a
local comedian.
Some people know him as comedian Josh Sneed, who's done some national shows, including, you know, his own special on Comedy Central. He does stuff around town, but he's also one of the guys behind Cincy Shirts. And who doesn't have a Cincy shirt in their collection somewhere?
I probably have several.
I'm sure you do, because you love all things Cincinnati, and that's what's cool about Cincy Shirts. But yeah, so we're going to mix the fun and jovial with the serious Futures Commission report. So this is when I interview you, Sherry, because we want to break down what the Futures Commission report is, how it came to be, and some of the key findings. And there's no one better than you. You not only wrote the story, but you apparently read the entire 74-page document, which is right here.
This is what they look like when you're done with them, with all those little sticky notes.
All right. So let's go to the beginning. Why was the Futures Commission even charged with coming up with these recommendations?
You know, we really did have in 2021, at the end, a big government change in Cincinnati. And we saw Mayor Aftab Puraval be elected, almost all new council members. And I think, not being cynical and having covered it a long time, I think they were really thinking to themselves, this is a little scary. There's a lot of deficits. There's a lot of problems, it seems like. And they felt like, you know, they were a little bit out of their depth. You learn as you go in City Hall, even when you can, even now I learn things at City Hall.
But there was an acknowledgement that there was some big shifts in the funding structure of the city coming out of the pandemic, and a recognition by the mayor and probably others that we need to put together some of the top thinkers of all things, you know, city policy, budget, and let them study this, let them provide some guidance. Of course, a panel like this, a commission, nothing they do is binding. It's all recommendations. There's a lot of work to be done. But if I'm oversimplifying it, you can fill in some of the gaps. But basically, the two big shifts in how the city raises money that happened after the pandemic. The one is that there's nobody working downtown, at least not to the level. There are. We are working downtown right now. But
yes,
compared to prior to the pandemic, the earnings tax took a hit.
Yes.
Because you have fewer people coming downtown to work or on their taxes, you know, paying the earnings tax. And then you also have the end of the COVID relief funding, like a double-edged sword.
I know. So this budget's the last money where there's a lot of federal government money to kind of prop things up and do the things they kind of want to do. And so it was like, what was this going to look like? So it needed to be an outside review. You never really can look at things yourself. So going back in history, Mayor Puraval took a page out of, you know,
Mayor Lucan's playbook,
yeah. And, you know, called for, you know, a commission. And he tapped John Mohler, the president and CEO of Procter & Gamble.
And former podcast guest,
to do this. And he selected the people on it. And these are some of, like, you know, of our big company owners, civic leaders.
And a larger commission than the Smale Commission, too. I believe
it was. Yes. The Smale Commission was 10 people and this was a 34-person commission. They did break down into three committees, but I mean, Philip Holloman, I believe from Cintas, Katie Blackburn and
from
Tim Spence were kind of like the vice chairs. So like the big
Tim
names,
Spence from Fifth Third,
from Fifth Third.
Katie Blackburn
and
from the Bengals.
They know big business and they looked at the city like a business.
Right. They understand how a large business operates, and that's sort of the lens that they took this challenge through. Like, what types of business decisions does the city need to do to stabilize its revenue, stabilize its budget, and position itself, you know, because that's what this commission is called, the Futures Commission, position the city for future growth, and not every year having to cut costs to balance the budget.
So I will say, going back to the Smale Commission, it's technically called like the Cincinnati Infrastructure Report, which, by the way, you could check it out of your public library. I know this because I'm doing it.
So you're going to go back and look at the infrastructure of the Smale Report.
It took a minute for it to come in. I'll be picking it up actually on my way home today.
Okay. Because so many other people, checked it out? You had to wait for someone to return it?
I did have to wait. I don't know how many people, but I had to wait a minute.
It was probably someone on the
Futures
Commission.
That's true. They just returned it.
Yeah, because they were officially decommissioned this week, or as we record it this week. Okay, so give us, for someone who's not been paying attention, who doesn't care about, you know, the inner workings of the city, break this down in a very layman's approach to, like, what are the big recommendations and why should we care about them?
So first of all, it's a $728 million plan, which, that's a lot of money. And the city, surprise, doesn't have $728 million right now.
Start right there. What does that even mean? Is it a plan to?
It is a plan to, I wrote this sentence this morning in a story for Monday, is a plan to stabilize the city's budget, to grow the city, and to right-size things for the future so that we are a successful city. It's basically
so when you
parts.
Put that price tag on the plan, or when they put that price tag, it is, the plan is designed to free up that money. Like, that's money that needs
less
to
free
be
free up and more dedicated to.
Right.
Come up with the money and then dedicate it to very specific things
so
that
not
will
just,
help the city
so
grow.
So not just spend this, but it also looks at how are you going to raise that money? Where's that money coming
Correct.
From? All right. So there's been a few things in terms of raising the money that have already raised some eyebrows. And one, that's charging for trash services in the city, which currently Cincinnati does not do.
Correct. And so you cannot look at this report and say to yourself, these are things I never heard of before, because a lot of these things have been suggested before as solutions to budget problems. And you know, they were not politically popular and they were not done. So they have come up here again in this report, and a trash fee is one of them. Cincinnati residents do pay. The tax burden is high in Cincinnati. A lot of it is for schools, which is not to say that is a bad thing, but it is true. Like, you know, buildings and the education of the students, there are the taxes. And one of the benefits that people have long seen is, well, the trash collection is free. And this recommends a trash fee of $15-some for a regular household each month, and for lower-income residents, $7.60. And it did not seem to be popular online. It was not popular in 2009 when it was first introduced. In fact, in 2011, there was a ballot initiative that put it in the charter that said trash collection will remain free
it's
forever.
It's in the city's charter. So that brings up a good point.
That's our constitution.
Some of these things the city council members will be able to address, you know, by the normal process, you know, coming up with ordinances, voting on them. But some of it will have to go to the voters at large, and the trash collection fee would be one of them because it's in the charter right now. You know, we're very early in the process here.
It isn't the biggest part of the plan. It
collects
$164 million over 10 years, but that is not to mean that I actually minimize it, because as a homeowner, $20 a month does matter.
It does.
But in the scheme of a $728 million plan,
right,
$164,000 over 10 years, not that much.
Not that big a deal. It is an example of something that would affect someone directly, where some of them may or may not affect someone directly. For example, selling off golf courses.
So in that case, now this land is very valuable, but nobody said, though, that they need to remain golf courses. Certainly, they could be leased out by someone who'd like to run a golf course. But the question that's the underpinning of that is they're valuable. And actually, the Smale Commission recommended selling one of the city golf courses. Did you know what happened to that?
No.
It did not get sold. They are something that make the city a special place. I think that that's going to be, some of these things are part of Cincinnati's character, which, you know, really wasn't discussed in the report or really, that's where the public discussion is coming in. Some of these things are who we are. The owning of Lunken Airport, the owning of parks that includes a forest. And so these are character things about Cincinnati. But the flip side is that, is can Cincinnati afford them?
Or does it make sense for the city to operate it when it's more of a regional thing, like Waterworks, the water utility?
Waterworks is the most complicated part of the process. But the short...
All right, well, walk us through that really quick.
The short version of it is that they suggested doing a regional water district. And, well, how would that be different? Because... somebody would take it over. The water district's worth like $650 million. The employees are part of the city's pension system, and that is not ideal. The pension system's not fully funded, and there's a lot of arguments, like fiscal arguments. Is that good or bad? Or because it's much more funded than it had been in the past, thanks to John Cranley really pulling a lot of people together and concessions on the city side and concessions on the employee side and concessions on the retiree side. It was a very difficult process. So it's more funded today than it was. Are any pensions really fully funded either? So I'm not going to be boring you guys too much with that. Carl is like, Sherry. But anyway, the water system.
But it's currently, the pension is currently on an unsustainable path.
That is what the commission said. So the idea is that if you regionalize Waterworks, then those people, the water employees in the pension system, would go over there, right-sizing the pension system a little bit there to help it. And then the whole pension system, and Cincinnati is the only city in Ohio that has its own pension system, could be turned over to the state. But the state right now is like, ooh, you're not fully funded. No, thank you. So they need to get it to a better
right,
place.
Right, yeah.
Letting go of water, the water district, would do that. But at the same time, that is also in our charter. So it was suggested before that Waterworks be sold, and that was kind of just to raise money in the past, and that did not go over well, and there was a ballot initiative, and they put it in the charter that Waterworks cannot be privatized, and now there's no one's using the word privatized in this, but it kind of is the same thing, so this is going to need
a charter. Well, it doesn't necessarily have to be privatized if they create a regional water authority, a multi-government regional water authority that would have a board appointed from all the municipalities that are served by the water. There's more than one way to get at it. But I think that's what people are fearing is that, okay, we're going to sell this and turn it over to a private concern. And then what control do we have over
None.
One of the most basic of utilities?
None. Now, but nobody is saying that it won't. That whatever this is, we have very high quality water here, that it wouldn't continue to be that. So
right.
It's not about that. It's more, it wouldn't be Cincinnati first because when now
that's a good
city
point.
Residents pay less for their water than all of the suburban areas. And they also, of course, the projects that get done are in the city. But once you regionalize it, somebody else's project would get prioritized some years. And things that, you know, you wanted to get done in your city maybe would not be done because you voted to turn it over to a regional water district. And so the rate thing is very scary. But to be fair, rates have gone up every year since 2008. The water district is basically limping along and covering all of its costs. And no one thinks that it should make money. But every year those costs go up. And the rates are going to go up. They're not like, oh, we raised rates like last year. We won't do it again. That's not a thing. They're going to have to keep going up anyway. But how much control do you want over that increase? And a lot of this gets at the idea of how much it costs to own your own home in Cincinnati. This is a very big conversation in Cincinnati of who can own homes. Do we have a middle class? And what does that look like? Because it's very expensive here to own a home. Our MSD costs are more than any of the surrounding areas because we're under consent decree to you know, fix the quality of all of the water in the sewer system, totally separate than water. It's very expensive. And so all of these things they're trying to balance out, it all goes into how can you afford to own your own home?
All right. So what do you think the likelihood is? Now, the mayor has already said that this is going to take some time. It is, at the end of the day, simply a list of recommendations.
We did not talk about the idea that it is also, there's some earnings tax increases.
Right.
As part of this. I mean, we could talk about
a small earnings tax.
Hours.
Yeah, small earnings tax increase. It would still, according to your reporting, Sherry, have us below the earnings tax rate of our sister cities in the state.
Yes, but
Columbus,
then you do have to marry that with the idea of whatever our property taxes.
Well, you're going to get it some. You're going to get taxed one way or the other.
This is true.
But I think it's safe to say that the city's history is full of examples of studies that everybody's excited about that get put in a nice, you know, bound three-ring binder.
I took
and they
one,
get set on the credenza and they are never looked at again.
I took one off of my at-home desk where I really, like, that's my main workspace because we have hotel desks here. And I do come downtown and work, but I just bring the work of the day. And I took that report and I put it in my filing cabinet. And now this pretty blue-covered, city-pictured report will sit on my desk. At least 5 years.
Sherry, when we moved from 312 Elm mm-hmm. to 312 Plum, there were, whether it was our library that we had mm-hmm. or file cabinets randomly around the newsroom, hundreds of commission, committee, special task force reports that, you know, from the 80s, 90s, early 2000s, you know.
I kept in my house, I took them, everything related to the banks. You want to know what those original bank sketches look like? I was not letting those go. And I have everything related to Paycor Stadium.
Well, I'm not
right
even talking about
us.
Development projects
but
like the banks.
No, those reports.
But like we've had so many special task forces, so many commissions. Do you think that this one will be as effective as the Smail Commission was in guiding our elected leaders?
The question, it's almost two different questions because someone is going to have to take the lead on this, whereas the Smail Commission itself took the lead. They stayed convened. They put forward their plan. It was $217 million, and it involved earnings tax increase, and they championed that, and they took it to the ballot, and it passed with like 50.5 wide. Like it was the most narrow.
Right.
Of any I've seen, really. And so they did it. So the question is, will somebody at the city really pick up the ball and do this? The commission said, and it was a little funny, the commission said it's kind of all or nothing. Like if you save a little bit here and a little bit there, it doesn't really matter. You have to do all of these things, partly because you need a lot of money to do the big things they're asking, because that creates jobs in the theory of this report, creates jobs, higher wages, more places to work without a college degree. It creates a lot of those things. So if you don't do all of those things, then you can't afford to do the things that'll make you be able to afford to do those other things. This is very circular. But someone is going to have to commit the political capital to this. And I'm not sure at this point where that's coming from. We'll see. Of course, everyone told me. And I was being very fair yesterday. I asked a very specific set of questions to all of our elected leaders, and not one of them answered the questions. They all said they're looking at it, but I felt like that was very fair because it is a lot to digest.
Right.
And you don't want to, I don't want them to have a knee-jerk reaction. However, whether they do things or whether they don't, it is a living document, and it does say some very important things. And it says the pension system's not okay. The city budget's not okay. And so no matter what happens now, there is really this document from the brightest of our city that say you need to do these things. So even if they don't do the things in this report, but then let's say I mean, I have been using this example. There's a lot of talk about expanding the streetcar, but I think it's difficult to have that conversation in a context where a report is in front of our faces that say such serious things. And so I think any time they want to do things or spend money, having done none of this or maybe coming up with their own ideas to do some of the fixes, they would be saying that this commission report isn't right or isn't true. And it's just more of the same at City Hall. So this document, I do think it, no matter what happens to it, will be a governing document going forward.
All right. Fair enough. Well, let's completely shift gears.
Mm-hmm. There'll be plenty of time to talk about all of the things as they come up, and I write about them.
You know, there'll be a lot more to come. But right now, we're going to talk to Josh Sneed.
Special guest time here on That's So Cincinnati, a little lighter this week. I'm pleased to welcome Josh Sneed.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
So I first, I think, came across you, Josh, because we are both involved with Men Wear Pink.
Yep.
And I knew you as the Cincy Shirts guy.
Yeah.
And then I figured out you were also this like well-known comedian. And so, you know, you cross paths with a lot of different people because of a lot of different things that you're involved in. So I don't even know where to start, but I guess I want to start with Cincy Shirts. How did that idea jump into your head?
So it's funny because it goes both ways. You know, some people like can't believe I'm a comedian because they know me from Cincy Shirts. And then other people are like, oh, you own Cincy Shirts?
You run a business?
Yeah.
Like comedians aren't capable of being organized to run a business.
So I started in 1998 doing stand-up, and it was a month before my 21st birthday. And almost immediately I was meeting headliners that were, you know, late 60s, early 70s. Comedy was the only thing they knew. They lived out of a suitcase. They had no personal relationships because they spent their entire life on the road. And they hated stand-up for it, you know? And I remember even that young and at that new in the business, it left an impression on me that I never wanted to get to a point where I hated doing comedy. And so it was always in the back of my mind to have like something else, right? Something to kind of supplement the income, because back then I was single, no kids. I didn't need extra money to support anybody but me, but I knew there would come a day where that would be important. So a friend of mine who went to the arts academy, very talented artist, entrepreneur minded like myself. We were trying to figure out a way to work together. And at that time, this was about 2005, funny t-shirts were all the rage. There was like busted tees and snorg tees. And, you know, it was a lot of pop culture reference stuff, just movie quotes on shirts. And so I thought, well, you know, he could do the designs and then I could talk about him when I was out on the road doing stand-up at radio stations or at the comedy clubs. And so we decided to launch this funny t-shirt brand called Look At Me Shirts. And because we just thought that everybody that wore those shirts was like, hey, look at me. And and so that was the name of it. And we, you know, it was like I said, it was a lot of funny movie lines, but we always had like a little section of Cincinnati funny shirts. We opened our first little store in Dayton, Kentucky, where we were printing out of the back, and we had this retail area up front. And for that specifically, we wanted like local reference shirts. And the first shirt that ever got us press in the Enquirer was, it was just a black shirt with white letters that said, "Even God hates the Steelers." And it just went whatever you could call viral back then without, you know, social media being a big thing. People started showing up at our store. And so we started doing more and more local designs and just gave it like a Cincinnati section on the website. But growing up here, I always had a love for all the old stores and restaurants and places like that that weren't around anymore. But whenever I would see the logo, it would instantly bring like memories, you know? So Mama's Cookies was one of them, you know, Americana Amusement Park, Caddy's, all these places that I remembered. And if you grew up here, you remember Johnny's Toys. Mm-hmm. But the problem was we were screen printing and all these logos had like tons of colors in it. And there was just, we weren't doing the business where we could justify having inventory of all this stuff. So it was just kind of a dream.
So you're basically making them on demand.
Yeah. Well, back then we were doing very simple one color designs mm-hmm. that didn't take a lot of setup. But then, you know, fast forward a couple of years, we partnered with this company out of Mason called Touchstone, and they had this new printer that could do print on demand, full color. And so I was like, this is our chance to do like a vintage Cincinnati brand. And so that's how Cincy Shirts was born. And almost immediately, the sales from Cincy Shirts were surpassing the Look At Me shirt sales, because Look At Me shirts was kind of like a site where you went to and you're like, oh, these are funny, but I like that one shirt. If I showed Cincy shirts to someone who grew up here, they're like, I want all of these.
Right.
And so as word spread about the website, you know, our sales went up. We started setting up booths at, you know, Bunbury and Brouhaha and events like that. And then, you know, people would always say, where's your store? Oh, we're just online, you know? And then right around Christmas, it was like, you know, 3 days before Christmas, where's your store? Well, we don't have one. So finally we were like, let's just see if we could do like that Halloween Express approach and find like some little spot for a couple months during Christmas, just even if it was for that last like 2 weeks of sales that we, you know, the post office was cut off by then. So we were just missing out. And there was a place on Main Street, a little boutique. The person had recently moved out. They gave us a 3-month lease, November, December, and January 2014. And so we bought some fixtures off of Craigslist and printed what we thought were our best sellers and opened the door and had a great 3 months. And then they offered us another year. And that's when the All-Star Game was here in the summer of 2015. So we're like, yeah, let's just be downtown for that, you know? And so we stayed around for the next year. FC Cincinnati was announced. We set up a meeting with them after we bought season tickets to do fan gear. They were kind of like, we haven't even played a game. We don't even know if anybody's going to come. And I was like, well, you guys are making the jerseys and the scarves. Let us make t-shirts for people to wear when they go to the matches. And of course, you know, second match, they break the league attendance record. And they hadn't prepared for that kind of, you know, turnout. So, you know, thousands of people every week were looking for gear to wear to their first ever FC Cincinnati match. And we were the only ones selling it. So they, you know, we used that money to open Hyde Park.
This is very serendipitous.
Yeah. And then Fiona was born, and oh, that changed my, the game.
In the timeline of very important things that happened. Very, and then Fiona was born. Yeah.
And that let us open up our Loveland store. And, you know, we ended up getting a warehouse space at the Essex Studios over in Clifton, where we could print and ship out of when we outgrew our little back room at Hyde Park. And, I mean, it's just been wild. You know, we've just grown and, like, looking back, it all started because some grumpy headliner was like, I hate doing stand-up. Get out while you can, you know? And it's afforded me the opportunity to, you know, have a wife and kids that I get to see as much as I want to and do stand-up when I want to. So they've kind of both been my thing, you know?
And the cleverness as a joke writer, because, I mean, you write all your own stuff.
Yeah.
I'm sure that paired nicely with the creativeness required to come up with some of these shirt ideas.
Yeah, it's weird. It's like a different part of the creative brain, but they go kind of hand in hand. You know, there's certain things that visually are funnier than right. audibly, you know?
Yeah, but I think what ties it together is knowing what's going to land.
That's
knowing big, your yes. audience.
And the social media side of it too, of like, you know, figuring out how to put out stuff that's engaging and doesn't just feel like we're constantly trying to sell stuff.
So before we sat down to record, I was jotting down the Cincy shirts that we have just in the Love household.
Okay.
And there are six.
Ooh.
I almost forgot one. So we, of course, have Cincy Strong, because when I moved back to town, it was just before the fifth third shooting. And so you guys came up with out with Cincy Strong. And just, you know, one of the many ways that the community pulled together and showing support after that horrible day. my favorite Cracker Bomb. My kid stole it from me and wears it because we, you know, he at a very young age was doing Cracker Bombs.
Yeah.
The Loveland Frogman.
That has to be a Skyline thing, I'm guessing.
Wait a minute. Record scratch, Phil.
I'm not from here.
You don't know what a Cracker Bomb is?
No, Jack might know, though. I don't know.
Oh, Sherry. Oh, okay. Well, we'll have. I'll take care of that, Josh. Okay.
All right, sure, sure. All right, Cracker Bomb.
Loveland Frogman.
Okay, yeah, of course.
Hilarious.
Yes.
One I had to get because in my Cincinnati Reds theme bar, I have some glasses from Johnny Bench's home plate.
Yeah.
And so I had to get, you know, you guys did the shirt with the home Johnny Bench's home plate, his restaurant he had in the 70s and 80s here.
Yep.
We have Jonathan Baseball, which is homage to Jonathan India. And then, of course, the one we partnered on, which I almost forgot, when the Bengals went to the Super Bowl, we brought out the classic Jim Borgman Next cartoon.
Yeah.
And
iconic.
Iconic. So many questions. How do you handle permission rights, or do you go by the, well, it's better to ask for forgiveness than permission?
Well, approach? If you had asked me, you know, a long time ago, it would have been a different answer. For sure, it was, you know, better to ask for forgiveness than permission, or easier, I should say. Yeah.
But for example, I mean, somebody probably still owns the mark for Johnny Bench's home plate, or maybe they don't.
I don't know if someone does. He is an example of someone we have a agreement with. Mm-hmm. So, you know, any form we have an MLB Players Association license, which we can do shirts for any current MLB player. And then there's certain select former MLB players that, you know, we've worked with, you know, George Foster, Johnny Bench, Pete Rose, folks like that. So I would assume he owns that mark. I don't know if he does or not, but no one's ever come up and said, hey, we try to do our homework now to see who's got the rights to something and do all the right channels, just because we're too big of, I mean, we're not a big business, but there's too many people that I'm responsible for to be careless.
You have to act like a grown up now.
I do. It's so weird. You know, it's unfortunate. You know, back in the day when it was just Darren and I mean, until we opened our first store in 2014, so 9 years, it was just he and I, and we were the only ones that we had to answer for whatever we got in trouble for.
So what are some of your favorite, not just best, like, well, what is the best? Is it the Fiona shirt? What is your best selling shirt?
All time top seller would probably be the original Fiona design, the Feeling Hip, which it's funny because we had a relationship with the Zoo, you know, before we entered into this like sort of current businesses and city pride type of designs. Originally, it was all vintage. I mean, and the reason that was because the trademarks for a lot of those places had expired.
Right.
And so there was no one to ask permission of, you know? And so that's why we leaned into that. Plus just, you know, people are from here, proud of being from here and very nostalgic. And so, those were our best sellers. And
which
then,
reminds me, you guys did the Little Kings one, right?
Little Kings.
That's seven.
Yeah.
Okay. So I'm just doing the math, Sherry. If a random household like mine has seven Cincy shirts, if you multiply that across greater Cincinnati, you guys have sold a shit ton of t-shirts.
We've sold a bunch.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's wild.
And when you're in the moment for pop culture, do they sell right out immediately?
Well, that's the beauty of on demand. I mean, that's why we've lived in that space, is because we can just throw every idea we have up against the wall. And if we print one, we print one. You know, we're not looking at an inventory of a ton of stuff that we're like, how are we going to get rid of this? I mean, once in a while, we'll do something fun that we think will move. Like we did toilet paper last year for the Steelers game. And it was basically toilet paper we had custom made that was yellow. It looked like the terrible towel, but it says the terrible bowel. And so we sold it to Bengals fans who wanted to use that to clean up in the bathroom. So
you're not a Steelers fan.
But you know, it's, to say what my favorite is tough. The thing about Fiona that I find funny is we had a relationship with the Zoo doing old Zoo designs. And funny ones too. Like one of my favorite ones that never sold, but I thought was funny. It said, "I'm just here for the botanical garden." Cause it was always like, but they were like, when they weren't sure if Fiona was going to live, they were just like, we need to make sure she's going to survive. And then when they figured that she was going to make it, they did their own t-shirt and GoFundMe. And after that was exhausted, then they were like, if you guys still want to do a shirt, you can, you know, kind of like.
Yeah, she's not as popular anymore.
We put that out. And
it's still insatiable, that little girl.
between the Fiona, Team Fiona in general, all the stuff we've done, including the partnership to raise money for their sister zoo in Australia when they had the wildfires. We've raised over $500,000 for Team Fiona total, which is wild.
Yeah, you know? It is wild.
I would say a lot of my favorite shirts never made it to.
Getting somewhere. Yeah. We need to hear some of those.
Is the funniest place in our company probably, where it's we'll never get away with that.
So you guys like Teams or some kind of like Slack channel.
Yeah. And Google chat.
Okay.
And we kind of start with, oh, they'll never approve this. And then we whittle it down to, you know, what you end up seeing.
But give us a few.
Yeah.
Give us
a few. I'll tell you some of the stuff we don't sell anymore that was some of our early favorites. So we had this picture and it was like one of those old sort of like 1950s, like kind of, generic family photos of having dinner that we photoshopped, like, three ways and conies onto the table. And it said, Cincinnati chili, enjoy it with crackers, you know, cause it was just like the whitest people you've ever seen in your life. Man, I don't know. The first cease and desist we ever got was from Wendy's. That we had a picture of Dave Thomas with the spatula and it just said, "Damn, it feels good to be a gangster." You know, it's so random, but back then we were all about
the
randomness.
Don't they have a sense of humor?
No.
You know, it's funny because like I'd never gotten a cease and desist. I'm like, great, we just now started this company.
Some cred.
Did it come in the mail or the email?
It came in the mail and I wrote them back. I was like, you know, I was like worried they're going to sue our company. We're going to have to shut down. And I wrote this ridiculously long letter that's, you know, Wendy's was my first job. We love the company. We weren't trying to upset anybody. You know, it was like this insanely over the top, you know, love story to Wendy's. And they wrote back, they're like, no, it's cool. Just don't sell them anymore.
Yeah.
Like, they didn't care. Right. You know.
Lawyers famous for not, you know, being emotional.
Yeah.
It's a nice story, but
yeah, not everybody's been that kind.
All right. But you said first cease and desist. So
yeah. Oh, we've gotten plenty. I mean, you know, we got a cease and desist for the Even God Hates the Steelers, you know. Sometimes people really
from
overstep.
The Steelers?
From the NFL.
Okay.
From an agency that claimed that they represented the NFL. We were never really sure if they did or not, but they got our website turned off and it was like down for like a week and a half. It was a nightmare.
Wow.
Yeah. Well, Ohio State's a real bad one. If you use scarlet and gray in anything, whether it says Ohio State or Buckeyes or anything, they will shut you down.
That seems a little over the top. They
but
don't
seems
own.
It seems on brand for the Ohio State University.
They do not own colors. Yeah.
They do. There's a court case that they reference. It's a very famous one in the t-shirt industry with this company called Smack Apparel. And it went all the way to the Supreme Court. And it was ruled that a team's color schemes can be trademarked, you know, so that if you put out a, you know, black and orange shirt that is aimed at a football fan, in theory, they could reference that court case and say, you're misleading people into thinking this is actual NFL merchandise, which is crazy, but unfortunately true.
Well, it makes sense.
Wait.
Oh, go ahead.
Has anyone ever stolen your designs?
Every day.
Every day.
Every single day. And it's almost funny. It's not funny, but it's almost funny that the second we put up a shirt now, it will appear on 15 different bootleg websites.
Wow.
This is how bad it's gotten. I find this fascinating as a former tech guy. That was my day job before I went comedy.
We're going to ask you about that. That'll be the next thing.
Okay.
I have a question.
So It has gotten so bad that there is a bot, basically, that will go to Twitter and it will look for tweets that say, look at this awesome shirt I got. It will take the image. It will go to a bootleg website and upload that image as a new design on a t-shirt. It will take that link and then go back to the original Twitter post and reply as a comment. I got one too. Here's the link. And they just, it's automated. Wow. And it happens quicker than you can shut it down. And it's insane. It's like crazy how quick our stuff shows up on other sites. We even put watermarks on it for a while to try to deter it. And they were just uploading the images with the watermark on it.
Do you have someone just kind of paying attention to that, or you just let it be?
We try to. The problem is we live in such a viral, you know, like that's the space is where we thrive, is like, what are people talking about right now? So a lot of times our designs will be popular for a few days, maybe a week. And by the time you would be able to get it shut down on another website, that window of sales is closed. So we just try to like be first to market, hit it as hard as we can so that it gets out there that we're the ones that have that shirt. And then we're on to the next thing.
So you mentioned you're a tech guy, but you didn't say specifically that you worked at P&G.
Yeah.
Like those are dream jobs. And, but like most, a lot of our very, you know, most successful entrepreneurs in this community, you do have that P&G on your resume, mm-hmm. but it looks like it, you didn't leave P&G to start a very successful t-shirt company. You left to be a comedian.
That's right.
How did that go over with your parents?
Well, I mean, as you mentioned, here locally, P&G holds so much weight, right? It just talking about it, people are like, oh, of course. You know, my mom retired from P&G. My grandmother retired from P&G. So to tell them that I was leaving P&G to go anywhere, even another big company, was like, what, why would you do that? You know, to tell jokes especially was a bit of a shock. But you know, I was 24 and I felt like I was at an age that if it didn't work out, I could still get back into corporate America. And you know, I ended up touring with the Blue Collar Comedy Tour guys, and one of the shows had me opening for Larry the Cable Guy at the Taft. And all of my family came out to see the show, and it just, I think that was when they realized like maybe he's onto something here, you know? And it was just that was such a memorable show for me, because I used to sit across the street at P&G and look at the Taft when I'd see, you know, Stephen Wright and other comedians that I loved coming there. Like, how cool would it be to play the Taft? And then I was at the Taft looking back across the street at P&G, like realizing like, you know, I had achieved a real benchmark for
me. Well, you didn't just wake up at age 24 and go, I'm going to be a comedian. It had to be something you were interested in for a long time. You mentioned, you know, the comedians that you like Stephen Wright, mm-hmm. who has written one of my all time favorite, like one liner jokes, where he just looks at the audience and says, I have every eraser to every miniature golf pencil in the world. Like, I always wondered where all those erasers
went. That's hilarious.
I know, you know what I mean? It's just like that. I have that kind of quirky, like,
he said my favorite thing ever to get off stage. I saw him at the Taft one year, and he had been up there for like an hour and 20 minutes. And he goes, my parents taught me to never talk to strangers. And then he just walked off the stage. And I was like, that is so brilliant. I loved him. But
when did you kind of catch the bug?
I think I got it from my dad. My dad was a model maker at Kenner Toys here in Cincinnati. So you're
like a walking Cincinnati.
Yes, this is
that's
true.
That's why when you said guy, that's so Cincinnati, yeah. I'm like,
so does he have some of the original like Star Wars character sketches? I mean, was he?
So my dad,
we're going down a rabbit hole now. The Kenner Star Wars figures.
I mean, I'll be.
But
here
let me point out one thing. His first job was Wendy's.
That's right.
Well, your first job was
Skyline.
Your resume is missing. My first
real job. Like there was this Greek guy that owned an apartment building, and I would like, you know, before I was old enough to work, I would go like cut the lawn there and empty the garbage cans in the laundry room or whatever. But my first, like, I got a real job was at Skyline.
That's awesome.
That's why I know what a Cracker Bomb is.
Yeah, right? Man. You were raised on it. My dad had the best sense of humor. I think, you know, I think just his personality in general was that way. But I think working at a place like Kenner really amplified it because he's just like, he's a big kid, you know? And so that made an impression on me at a very early age. I was always drawn to, you know, like my sense of humor was shaped by all the stuff that I watched, you know, in the 80s, Saturday Night Live, and then, you know, Fletch and Ghostbusters and, you know, just like Caddyshack, Airplane. I loved Wordplay. I loved SNL. I was obsessed with SNL. And that was kind of what got me to try my first open mic night. I wanted to be on SNL, but I didn't know how to do it, especially living here. So I just decided to try an open mic night, and I just eventually fell in love with stand-up. Like I said, I was single with no kids, so I spent every minute I had at the comedy club just as a sponge.
Which one?
Go Bananas, okay. Up in Montgomery. Mm-hmm. And just watching it. And then eventually I took over the open mic night there, and that really got me in good with the club to get more work as the MC. And I would just really get to cherry pick when big name comedians came to town, which ones I wanted to work with. And then I made relationships with them and got tips and advice from them. And then, you know, it was taking up more and more of my time at night, and I was at P&G during the day. And I knew I was getting to a point where I kind of really had to pick one or the other because I couldn't keep doing both. And P&G announced cutbacks. And before they laid anyone off, they said, who wants to go? And I raised my hand and I was like, well, this is my chance to, you know, get like a 6-month salary and benefits cushion for transitioning from, mm-hmm. you know, to being a full-time comic. And so I left in July of 2001. And that next 6 months, I just tried to book as many gigs as I could for 2002. And then that year I spent 50 out of 52 weeks on the road, 2002. And it just got me so much better at stand up. It opened so many more doors. And that was kind of my jump start into full-time comedy. And then, you know, I just slowly built that into, you know, getting into the Montreal Comedy Festival and then getting on Comedy Central. And then that got me my half hour, that got me my album deal. And it just kind of grew from there.
Was the Comedy Central, appearance what put you on the map outside of our region? Would you say that was like, you mentioned like your family realizing that, okay, he's onto something here when you open for Larry the Cable Guy. But as far as like, okay, I have achieved this.
Real credit.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That first appearance was, you know, anytime you get your first TV appearance is a big deal. The half hour special, the Comedy Central Presents, was like that's kind of what makes you go from the middle act to a headliner. Mm-hmm. That's enough of a credit that clubs will start closing you. And that was another one of those like surreal moments for me in comedy, was because I used to watch that show, you know, before I started doing stand up. And of course in the beginning, you know, cause at that time, if you did a half hour, you got to pick what your backdrop looked like. And my buddies and I would sit around and just be like, what would you do for your backdrop? You know? And I always had this idea of like being in detention, you know, like an empty classroom and then a teacher at the desk and I'm writing sentences on the chalkboard, you know, and I turn around and I start my special. And, cause that was my thing in high school, is I was a good student, but I got a lot of detentions cause I was making jokes.
Now you brought it up. So we have to be, so Cincinnati, ask you, where did you go to high school?
I went to St. Bernard Elmwood Place High School, okay. Home of the Titans.
Yeah.
And I'm honored to be their keynote speaker at the Hall of Fame banquet in a couple of weeks. So I'm excited to go back there and be the speaker.
So good segue to, you have some stuff coming up that we should let people know about.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Like, you're a busy guy.
I'm trying to be. April 19th and 20th, Friday, Saturday, I'm at the Funny Bone up in Dayton in Beaver Creek at the Green. Very nice club. It's as close as I'll be around Cincinnati for doing a headlining set. So if you want to come see the full show, come up to the Funny Bone in Dayton next weekend, or this weekend, I guess. And then, I started a new show the first Tuesday of every month. I'm at the Madison Theater in Covington. It's this awesome venue. It's called Joke Gym, and it's me and three other, you know, professional headlining comedians, and then a couple, you know, people who are a little bit newer in the business, and we're all trying out new material, and we all give each other feedback on that material. It's a very positive. It's not like a roast or anything, but we do it in front of a live audience, and we've done two of them so far, and they're hysterical. I mean, it's just, I think people really enjoy seeing kind of how the sausage gets made for what comics do in like a writing session. So, I highly recommend if you can make a Joke Gym show, first Tuesday of every month at the Madison Theater. It's only $10.
So do you feel like comedy since you started has shifted a little bit? First of all, it does seem like there's just a ton of comics coming through now. More than there have been in the past, but it might be like a post-COVID kind of feeling. And also, there just seems to be more of them.
Yes.
Is that a TikTok phenomenon?
I think that's part of it, for sure. I think COVID helped stand up a lot. You know, people were at home. They got introduced to people maybe they haven't heard of before. I think there's so many platforms. You know, it used to be Comedy Central, you know, or maybe an HBO special, but people doing those were pretty much established by that point. So getting new comedy was, you know, there weren't a lot of places to go. And then with the, you know, evolution of satellite radio and streaming services and YouTube and, you know, all the social media channels, it's become so much easier to share. You know, podcasts, another great tool that have put comedians on the map. For me, it's shifted in different ways. You know, like some people complain about, you know, the cancel culture and, you know, how politically correct you have to be. But I've always been a comic that's been pretty clean. That's just the way that I've always been.
That's so Cincinnati of you.
Well, like you get more work that way, you know? And the guy that kind of helped me get going back in the day, he said something that I still remember to this day. He said, you know, treat profanity like a spice. He's like, it can make a steak taste really good, but no one would eat a plate of oregano for dinner. And I've never forgotten that line. And I always leaned into that because I learned you got more work. You got more corporate gigs. You could open for more headliners because they knew you were safe to put in front of any crowd or any comedian. And I've just haven't had to navigate this sort of like, you know, worried about getting canceled because I really don't say anything that's edgy enough to get me canceled. So I've been lucky in that regard and I haven't really had to adapt or change my act for that. But the sheer number of comedians that you mentioned, yeah, you know, it's weird that someone who just goes viral on TikTok, who's done stand up for 6 months, can sell out two shows on a Thursday. And that's more lucrative to a comedy club than having me on a Friday or Saturday, you know? So it's this balance of trying to refine my craft and be just as good at stand up as I can be, but also figure out a way to market myself in the current, you know, state of comedy marketing, because it's a very crowded space
on social media.
Yeah.
So we're running up on time. I do want to know about your process a little bit. Do you like set aside time for a comedy? Like, I'm going to sit down tomorrow at 4 o'clock and write for 2 hours? Or are you constantly, you know, like observing things and then stopping and writing it down, or, you know, doing a voice memo into your phone? Like, how do you approach the craft?
The latter, for sure. I used to be a lot more disciplined. You know, back in the day, I read this book called The Artist's Way, and it was all about the morning pages. And it was this idea that if you woke up and you just made yourself write out 3 pages, even if it was just gibberish, that it would sort of clear out any cobwebs that were blocking like your real creative thought and like let that flow. And it just never worked for me. What I found when I would write stuff out is that when I would get on stage, I would sound like I was reciting something. You know, it would sound like I was doing lines that I had memorized, you know, in my style, what's worked for me is to be more relaxed, laid back, conversational. The thing people tell me more than anything after a show is it was like you were just up there talking. Like I didn't feel like I was at a comedy show. You were just, you know, you were just like a dude on my couch, like telling stories. And that's what I want. And what I've learned is if I take that approach that you mentioned of just sort of having an idea of what the joke is about and maybe even what the punchline is, if I wait until I'm on stage to work it out, I'll eventually, with enough practice, get it down to a pretty concise bit, but I force myself to do it in the way that I would normally talk off stage. So it doesn't sound too polished or too rehearsed because I'm literally writing the joke in the moment on the stage, even if I just have like an outline or a framework of what I want to say.
Do you do like the riffing with like, the audience?
I try not to. I really try not to.
That does tend to be mean, usually.
It can be mean, but also that's one of the downfalls, I think, of like the TikTok and like those videos going viral is I feel like it breeds a bad audience member that maybe doesn't know that the majority of comedians would like for you to just sit there and listen instead of interjecting. Yeah. And so, you know, my thing is like the comedians that I like the most and where I feel like are my strong suits on stage are timing, you know, segues. I want it to feel like a cohesive 50 to an hour long story versus like, you know, 23 minute jokes. So to do that, there's a real pace that I like to have with, you know, ups and downs and that kind of thing. And that gets interrupted the more that you talk to the audience, you know. So if I have to interject, if something happens in the room that I can't ignore, or somebody's yelling out, you know, I'm lucky to be at a point in my career where I work places that there's usually staff that'll handle that for me. But if I have to, I will, you know, and I can go off script and weave my way back. But my preference would be to just like do my act.
Do you let people bring their phones in and record?
They don't, no place lets you record. Now, sometimes people take a photo or something, you know, for comics, it's not about anything more than, you know, you're working, like I said, I'm working on stuff at a comedy club, you know, and this joke that I really like, I might not get it to where I'm ready to record it in a professional setting for a couple of months. So the last thing I want is someone recording that joke in its infancy and it getting out on online before I feel like I'm ready for people to see it.
It's not matured yet into the fine wine of a joke. That, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, to close this out, I'm going to put you on the spot and you can say no, but do you want to share a recent joke you've written or an observation or test anything out on us? Got something?
To test something out on you? Wow. That is putting me on the spot. I'm trying to think. There's a lot of new stuff I'm working on right now. One of the, you know, I try to write about stuff that is relatable, but also very specific to me, right? So one of the things that I'm going through now, I've had this idea for a TV show forever, is it was called Josh of All Trades. And it was basically the theme of it is that my dad could do anything. Like he was not a carpenter. He was not an electrician. He was not a plumber. He was not a mechanic, but he could fix any of that stuff. I can't do any of that stuff. And I think it's a generational thing. And so the idea for this show is that I would be going out and learning all the things, learning how to do all the things that a guy my age should know how to do, but most of us don't. And so I've started to weave some of that into my act about how I'm call a guy. I'm not fix it myself guy, you know? And because of that, I don't like the stores that are geared towards men. I make fun of my wife because she goes to Target. And I think that she doesn't really want to go to Target. She just wants Starbucks. She uses Target as an excuse to get Starbucks. And I say that, you know, I might like going to Lowe's more if there was a Buffalo Wild Wings when you walked inside, you know what I mean? So I'm really trying to build on this. I'm not a fix it myself guy. I'm not a man's man. I'm call a guy. And that's a big chunk of what I'm working on right now. So, but if you come to Joke Jam, you might be able to hear some new all parts right. of it.
Okay.
I'm intrigued.
Well, that was funny. So you're on the right track.
It's and a lot different on stage.
I do feel like people need to watch the show. You should do the show. People should watch the show because that is true.
Yeah.
Which comedy is rooted in the truth, right?
Yeah. I mean, all the great sitcoms, and maybe that's my problem, is that I'm still thinking about, you know, this traditional in front of a studio audience sitcom, which is not a thing anymore. But that was what I was raised on in comedy, was like, what's your point of view? What is the show going to be about you?
Who's the biggest comedian you've ever met?
Oh, man.
Or at least your dream person.
Can I be honest and you're not going to like the answer?
Sure. Well, wait, real quick.
At the time.
All the time I don't like people's answers. Go.
At the time, it was Bill Cosby. That was the biggest comedian I had ever met. He was my hero. He was the first comedy I ever saw. This was obviously before all the terrible things came out.
If you see all the clips go by on social media, there's so much nostalgia around it. It was really funny. It is a reckoning of what we know now and what was
it's a weird thing part to of compartmentalize. People's lives. Yeah, it's like this guy influenced me enough to want to do what I've done for 26 years. And then he's also like a terrible person.
They say never meet your heroes, but yeah.
Michael Jackson, same. Reckoning, like all of the music we grew up with, me at least, grew up with what we know.
Yeah. But what's really cool is like some of my peers that I started with are starting to reach that level that I think the next generation of comics will talk about the way that I talk about some of my heroes. But you know, Bill Burr and Tom Segura and Burt Kreischer and like all these guys, Nate Bargatze, that are selling out arenas, you know, like I came up with them. I'm friends with them, you know, and it's weird because I remember being that comic that's like, what? You met George Carlin? You met Sam Kinison? Like, that's insane. You know?
Wait, real quick. You're friends with Nate?
Yeah.
Is he as funny in person?
He's is hilarious. I just saw him a couple weeks ago in Vegas. He was at the Wynn and I was at the MGM Grand and I went and hung out with him. He's the best person.
Very fun.
He's probably my favorite comic working right now. And he's as good of a person as he's a comedian.
Do you have a special coming up?
That's what I'm trying to flush out is, I've got probably 10 more minutes I need to figure out and then I'll be ready to record hopefully before the end of the year. And I'm looking at places on, where I might do that. I'd like to do it here. But we'll see if it works out. I think Memorial Hall would be such a cool spot to shoot a special.
Agree. It's so nice in there.
All right. Well, Josh, thank you. I'm going to go home and see if there's a shirt that I didn't think about as your merchandise is infiltrated. Hey,
just drive me. I can get you another Cracker Bomb. If your kid took you the one you have, I got you.
All right. Awesome. Well, thanks, Josh.
Hey, thank you.
You know what, Burl? I needed to laugh. It's been a very serious week. In fact, I woke up this morning, even though I have a podcast of my own, thinking I'm not sure how much I can talk today because I've talked to so many people. It's been a very long week. But here I am chatting away.
Here we are.
And where did the week start?
Well, for you, it started at Miami Whitewater.
It did.
Because you were in, what, 100% totality total?
I was. It was amazing.
Which was one of the, if you wanted to stay in what we would call the greater Cincinnati area, that was one of the places to be for totality as you head west from Cincinnati. Cincinnati, I think downtown Cincinnati was 99.4% totality.
Yes, but what did Dean Regas tell us on this very podcast?
You need 100%.
It's all or nothing. It's like the Futures Commission report.
It's all or nothing. So yes, you and a team from the Enquirer documented the solar eclipse.
We did.
On Monday, as we record this.
I just cannot say enough amazing things about great parks. I had the best day at Miami Whitewater Forest.
They were prepared.
Really, they just, it was an incredible day.
So I just have to ask you, just as, you know, not Sherry the reporter, but Sherry the human being, how did it affect you? Did it change you? Was it what you expected? Had you seen one before?
I had not seen one before. I do think that Dean kind of gave me chills when he was describing it, and you do get that when you experience it because it does get we happened to be over the lake, Miami Whitewater Lake.
Mm-hmm.
And to have the sunset on the lake in the middle of the day, just like it would have been evening, and then the eclipse kind of happened, was an experience. Got chilly, you know, put on my sweatshirt. It was an experience. And my takeaway is that no picture online, not by our phenomenal photographers, not by, you know, photographers, the best in the world that were here to take pictures and you would see on social media, no picture does it justice.
I agree. And there's some phenomenal pictures.
But so you also went to see it. Where did you go? Yes.
Well, so Lauren has been planning this forever, and she's been stalking Dean Regas. And she asked Dean, where are you going to be? And he's like, I'm not deciding. Well, you know, it's what he said. Well, I'm not deciding until I see, you know, the weather forecast, you know, at maximum 2 days out, if not sooner. So he was prepared to go. What did he say? Buffalo to Art.
He did. You know?
He ended up at Wapakoneta, where we had
with Neil Armstrong. I thought that connection was nice.
Amazing. I'm glad the weather, you know, if you looked at the cloud cover maps, the weather did not look that great leading up to the eclipse. So Lauren saw that, you know, things were clearing up in Indiana. And so I said, okay, well, I've driven between Cincinnati and Indianapolis a bazillion times and have never stopped at some of these little places.
Indianapolis is a sister paper of ours.
It is, and the Columbus Dispatch as well. So they were all over the place at Wapakoneta. But anyway, I said, well, you know, there's like Batesville. And then I hear that Shelbyville's kind of cute. Like I have a little, you know, nostalgic Great American, you know, small town kind of still happening. So we, you know, we stopped in Batesville to get some pastries.
Yes.
From, help me, Schmidt's Bakery, home of the Thing-a-ling.
Cherry Thing-a-ling.
Yes, which we've talked about.
How were their regular day pastries?
Oh, it was fantastic. It was fantastic. So we did that, ended up in Shelbyville. And it was hilarious because this town has been, you know, they know that they've been in the path of totality. So they rolled out the red carpet for the people that they expected there. And they, I was talking to the owner of a bar. I know we ended up in a bar right before the eclipse, called Capone's Speakeasy. And
love
they
this.
Have like 50 bourbons, and it was just this cool place. And she was telling me that they have people in from Germany. It's Shelbyville, Indiana, the UK.
Somebody came to Miami Whitewater from San Francisco to our airport and Ubered to Miami Whitewater to see
it. Oh, yeah. Now, they were estimating, I also met the mayor too, which was kind of funny because when we first got there, we were walking around and I parked in a place that said, you know, limited 2 hour parking, and someone else was parking there. And this guy was like, oh, yeah, you can park there. We don't really enforce that. And I was just joking. I said, well, who are you, the mayor? And he's like, well, yes, I am. So I met the mayor of Shelbyville. But there it was cool because they have kind of like, you know, in the middle of town, there's like a roundabout with some statues and some grassy areas. And there's, you know, businesses were all in. And open so you could get food. And I don't know if they officially have a Dora, but, you know,
they people did were, for Eclipse Day.
They
yes.
did, yeah. And it was just really cool experiencing it with just a bunch of other people. And that kind of collective moment of awe where everybody's just like, oh my gosh, this is something I can't even describe. It's indescribable is the way I would.
I mean, it just nothing really does it justice.
No, because, you know, you can describe what it looks like and you can say it got dark and you can say, you know, oh, I couldn't believe I was able to take my eclipse glasses off and look at the, you know, once it was in, you know, fully eclipsed, you know, there's debate on this whether you should take your glasses off at that moment. I did. I can still see. Hopefully it didn't hurt my eyes. But when it's in full totality and you take those, you know, eclipse glasses off and you see it, you feel something too. And I'm not trying to like be all, you know, hippy dippy about
mystic.
It.
But I know,
yeah.
Agree.
But it is, I'm glad that Lauren dragged me out to do it because had she not been so into it, I would have just probably worked, seen it from downtown Cincinnati and looked at the pictures and I wouldn't have gotten it. You know, I get it.
You had to be, it was good that she dragged you because I did not drag Alex because he really wasn't that into it. And
does he have FOMO now?
He does. And but I kind of along was like, you have to want it.
Yeah.
Because it was a long day. You had to plan it and
go. Oh, yeah. You had to commit.
And like, even with some of my friends, who were like, we do want to do it, but it just seemed like a lot. I was like, you got to want it. You have to. But having sat in this very room where I am now with Dean, Phil confirmed that just the way he described it. I had to do it.
I'm glad you know. So Lauren's already like looking at like, you know, maybe we should go to Egypt and or
seen,
Spain.
Wait,
or
real
way
quick,
out,
I've seen one where, now. Yeah. And it was amazing, but I
here's
gonna.
How into it she was. I, you know, we were prepared to like make the day of it because you don't know how bad the traffic is going to be coming back. And it was bumper to bumper getting back from Shelbyville.
How long did it take you?
3 hours. Instead of an hour and 20 minutes.
But you know what they say about the West Side. It's hard to get from here to there. But guess what? When there's all back roads.
Oh, yeah.
We took the back roads all the way home.
I was trying to take back roads, but there's really not very many good options.
Kudos to Jill Jansen. We were the best team ever. It was me and my friend Jill, who grew up on the West Side. And Albert Cesar took the most amazing photos. And my child, who's about to be 16. Jill knew the West Side, so she was able to navigate us. Albert, we were just like his support team because you can't leave. You had to set up the cameras in the best space. You cannot leave them.
Yeah.
You can't. So, like, for Albert to even move away from them, the one of the three of us had to watch things.
Right.
Not that we didn't trust everyone who was there. And so we made, and then we brought every snack there ever was invented for Jack, and we ate them all.
Oh, yeah. It was a snack fest. And here's how cheesy Lauren is. I said, well, are we all set to go? I mean, we better have some snacks. We better make sure we have some waters to drink or whatever. I'll make sure the Jeep is filled with gas. And she's like, oh, I got snacks. And here's what she had purchased. She purchased a bag of Sun chips.
Love it.
Some moon pies.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And yeah. And
I
some,
like a good theme.
And some Eclipse gum. And I was like, I can't with you. This is just too much.
What did I tell you by text the night before? Because I was kind of getting ready to go.
I don't know. You texted me like 100 times. What
so,
did you tell me?
Preparing for dinner in Blanc.
Oh,
has,
yeah.
Has
oh, here
prepared
we go. You know what?
Me.
We need to like the bell. Ding, ding, ding. So or, you know, like they have in factories and things like that. Like, you know. 120 days without injury, you know. I think we've gone like maybe 10 podcasts without you mentioning dinner and Blanc.
True,
but now we got to start
been the winner.
Over.
Yeah.
We're back to zero podcasts. Yeah, big zero on the wall. So, yes, your preparations for dinner and Blanc where you have to bring everything you need.
Preparing for dinner and Blanc prepared me to prepare for anything. Coolers, picnic baskets, wagons, blankets. I was ready to go. Now, wait, you guys, that get back and like the Futures Commission started, like kind of behind the scenes stuff, the very next second.
Yeah.
And so Saturday morning at my house will be spent unpacking the car.
Oh, yeah. Well, it was a sight to see.
Yes.
I'm glad you got to see the full totality.
I'm counting it among, you know, the greatest moments I'll have ever had, partly because there was no cell service. I was with my son. He held my hand during the eclipse while like, we kind of laid on the blanket. And
aww.
Like, I just, a moment you can't recreate or
right.
have really again.
Yeah.
That's up there.
All right. Well, I think we have a podcast.
We do.
All right. Thanks, Sherry.